Now will you open your Bible, please, to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We're right in the middle of a beautiful section of Paul's letter to the Corinthians. The subject actually begins with chapter 8, but it continues through chapter 9 and all the way through to the end of chapter 10. There are times when you think that Paul has gotten into another subject, but really there's a thread that runs through these three chapters. And the thread or the theme that runs through these three chapters is expressed in verse 24 of chapter 10. Listen to 1 Corinthians 10:24 in the King James translation. Let no man seek his own, but every man another's wealth. Now that can be misinterpreted and misapplied, can't it? They say when you do business, there are two things to be gained, money and experience. And when you do business with some people, they always seem to get the money and you always seem to get the experience. It almost sounds as if this verse, 1 Corinthians 10:24, is saying, give the other man the experience, I'll seek his wealth. But that's really not what it means. Really, in revised translations, if you check this in a revised translation, you'll see that what it's saying is that we should be other-centered, that we should not seek our own good, but the good of the other man. The Apostle Paul was accused of being beside himself or eccentric, and there was enough evidence to convict him. In 2 Corinthians 5, he defends himself against the charge that he was beside himself or eccentric, and he says, there is enough evidence to convict me. I have a new center to my life since I met Jesus Christ on the road to Damascus. Christ is the center of my life. I believe until people are born again, self is the center of their life. Self is the center around which the lives of most people revolve. It's obvious, I think, when we hear things like self-preservation is the first law of civilization. But the Apostle Paul tells us by teaching an example that he, compared to other people, is eccentric. That's what the word was in the Greek when it said that they accused him of being beside himself. Paul says that all of us should be as he is. The first verse of chapter 11, they say, belongs with chapter 10 and should be a conclusion to all of these things he's sharing in chapters 8, 9, and 10. Be followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. That's the conclusion he comes to after giving us the teaching of these three chapters. In other words, we also should be Christ-centered, Christocentric, and we should be other-centered. That's really the point to what he's saying in these wonderful chapters. In chapter 8, he addressed this problem of whether or not believers in Corinth should eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols. Some in the church thought it was all right to do that. Some did not. And the Apostle Paul said in chapter 8, the issue is not what's right or what's wrong. The issue is not how much you know. You're so full of knowledge that you know there's nothing wrong with that meat. The important thing is love. How much do you love the weaker brother who thinks it is wrong to eat that meat? Well, that immediately raises the question, why should what I do or do not do be controlled by what somebody else thinks, especially because they're weak? If they think this or that because of their own weak conscience, why should that have any effect upon what I do or do not do? Well, that's why he emphasizes so often in this great section of Scripture, there are principles by which the life of every believer should be governed. At the end of chapter 10, he spells them out. The glory of God, everything you do, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, it should be to the glory of God. And then you should live in such a way that you don't cause anyone to stumble, whether they're Jews or Gentiles or believers. Paul pulls it all together in verse 33 at the end of chapter 10 when he says, even as I please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. That's the point that runs through these three chapters. Everything you do should be for the glory of God. It should be for the salvation of others. And at the heart of it all, you're not seeking your own profit, but the profit of others. You're Christ-centered and you're other-centered. Now, in chapter 9, we were looking at this in our last study. In verses 19 through 23, Paul gave us a tremendous statement. I believe we should all memorize this. We might call it his philosophy of ministry or his philosophy of relational evangelism. Listen to this great passage in the Living Bible. We looked at it in the Authorized Version in our last study. But listen to this in the Living Bible paraphrase. I have freely and happily become a slave of any and all so that I can win them to Christ. When I'm with the Jews, I seem as one of them, so that they will listen to the gospel, and I can win them to Christ. When I'm with Gentiles who follow Jewish customs and ceremonies, I don't argue, even though I don't agree, because I want to help them. When with the heathen, I agree with them as much as I can, except, of course, that I must always do what is right as a Christian. And so by agreeing, I can win their confidence and help them too. When I'm with those whose consciences bother them easily, I don't act as though I know it all and don't say they are foolish. The result is that they are willing to let me help them. Yes, whatever a person is like, I try to find some common ground with him so that he will let me tell him about Christ and let Christ save him. I do this to get the gospel to them, and also for the blessing I myself receive when I see them come to Christ. I think that's a magnificent statement of a philosophy of ministry that is based upon the fact that we are to be Christ-centered and other-centered because we know what our objective is. Our objective is to win men and women to Christ. And so we make the adjustments. We don't expect them to make the adjustments. We make the adjustments so that we might have our opportunity to present Christ to them. I often think that the church needs to hear this message because it almost seems as if the mentality of the church is we build our edifices, we're strategically placed in a community, we sort of run up our flag, and then we say, come and get it. And whenever they come, we do it our way. We don't think that much about where they are and how we can accommodate them or make adjustments to them so that we have our opportunity to present Christ to them. We just are what we are, and we expect them to make the adjustments when they come to us. The missionary vision of the New Testament is we're commissioned to go to them and make whatever adjustments we have to make so that we will have our opportunity to present Christ to them. Sometimes I think of the young people, especially in the 60s, who felt that they were different and they wanted to almost shock believers in the church. And sometimes I had young people who were gifted preachers and they would want to preach in denim overalls, in blue jeans. And I remember sharing with some of them, now listen, if you're here in this church and you're going to preach today, what are these people you're going to address? What are they in terms of this passage in 1 Corinthians 9? Are they Jews? Are they Gentiles? Are they the church of God? Paul said he would make any adjustments he had to make so that he could reach people in all these different categories. Now, he also said he would go as far as he could in reaching the lawless, the barbarian. But if you come to a Sunday morning congregation and people are dressed a certain way, what does that make them? They're not the lawless. They're not the barbarians. If you were going to reach people that were like that, then you would make another kind of adjustment. Perhaps that's when you'd wear your blue jeans and dress like a cowboy or something. But when you come to a Sunday morning congregation in a suburban church in America, well, if you want to reach those people, then you ought to dress the way that you will not be an offense to those people. There are so many ways we can apply this passage. Now, in summing up what Paul is saying in these three chapters, you might say that he puts it this way. When it comes to these gray issues, and that's what he's talking about, he's saying, it's not a matter of what's right or what's wrong. It's not a matter of how much you know about what's right or what's wrong. The important thing is how much you love the people who think it's wrong, even if it's because their conscience is weak and yours is strong. The important thing is not your conscience, it's their conscience. You're not to seek your own profit, but the profit of the other person. But he does say that gray issues like this can be resolved on the basis of conscience, but not your conscience, the other man's conscience. You see, it's consideration on your part of the other man. It's ultimately your love for the other man. That's the basis upon which these issues should be resolved. Now, as we read on in chapter 9, after this magnificent passage where Paul says he's all things to all men, that by all means he might save some, he puts in a closing teaching here. Listen to it in the Living Bible paraphrase. In a race, everyone runs, but only one person gets first prize. So run your race to win. To win the race, you must deny yourselves many things that would keep you from doing your best. An athlete goes to all this trouble just to win a blue ribbon or a silver cup. But we do it for a heavenly reward that never disappears. So I run straight to the goal with purpose in every step. I fight to win. I'm not just shadow boxing or playing around. Like an athlete, I punish my body, treating it roughly, training it to do what it should, not what it wants to. Otherwise, I fear that after enlisting others for the race, I myself might be declared unfit or ordered to stand aside. This is a great passage that concludes chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians. Listen to this. In the King James, perhaps it's more familiar to you in the King James or the Authorized Translation. Know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that you may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly. So fight I, not as one that beateth the air. But I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. When I was in high school, I was told to go out for the track team because I played football, and our football coach insisted that all his football players ran track in the spring. I wasn't really interested in winning or becoming a track star. That was not my strong suit, but I just had to go out for track because it was a rule if you wanted to play football. And so I was what they call an also-ran. When I competed in races, I wasn't trying to win. I was just there because I had to be there. And after running a very poor race, I'll never forget the track coach, in order to embarrass me, put in the newspaper the next day the results of that race. And the results were that Polanski was first, Virginio was second, and Mastrangelo was third. And then he put in there, and Woodward also ran. He did that to embarrass me, and it worked because I was very embarrassed. And I learned what an also-ran is. An also-ran is somebody who's running a race just because he's running, he isn't even thinking about winning. I learned as I came to appreciate that sport of track that runners, the good ones, the ones that run to win, are extremely disciplined, and they pace themselves for a race. Let's say the race is a one-mile race. Well, as they plan their race and as they pace themselves for their race, they pace themselves with their eye on the goal at the end of the race, the tape they're going to break at the end of the race. And if they pace themselves correctly, at the very instant that they break the tape or cross the goal at the end of the race, at that instant they will have given everything that could possibly be given to win that race. They don't want to give it too soon, or they might collapse on the track a quarter of a mile from the end of the race. And when they break the tape or cross the goal, they don't want to have a lot of energy that could have been used to win that race. The idea of pacing, the idea of a strategy for running a race, is to finish the race, and at the instant you finish the race, you've given everything that you could possibly give. That's what's involved in running to win. Now, the Apostle Paul applies that to the ministry that he outlined for us in verses 19 through 23 and his philosophy of ministry. The Apostle Paul knew what he was trying to do. He was trying to evangelize the world and all the people in the world. When he says, "I do this for the gospel's sake," that's what he means. He knows that that's his mission, that is his vision. And in order to accomplish or fulfill that mission and that vision, he gives us this great statement of his philosophy of ministry. Whatever people are, wherever they're coming from, insofar as I possibly can, I will become that to them, that I might have my hearing, that I might have my opportunity to present Christ to them. And I do that for the gospel's sake. Now, right on the heels of that, he gives this athletic illustration. It may be that Paul had been an athlete when he was young, because he uses a lot of athletic terminology and athletic illustrations. In Ephesians 6, he talks about wrestling, and here he uses several athletic illustrations. First, the race and the runner, and the difference between just running, being an also-ran, and running to win. And what he says is, in the race that is set before me, the life that I've been called to live in Christ and by Christ and for Christ, I'm running to win. Now, when he comes to the end of his life, his very last words are, "I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. I have fought a good fight." You see, he carries that thought through to the very end of his life, that this life and this ministry that stretches out before him at this point in his life when he writes 1 Corinthians 9, it's like a race. And I'm going to run to win. I'm going to pace myself so that when I come to the end of the race, there will not be anything I could have given that I didn't give. When he writes 2 Timothy chapter 4, he tells us that that was the case when he came to the end of his life. "I fought a good fight, I've finished the race, I've kept the faith." But here it's early in his life and ministry, and so he's telling us this is the way he looked at it. "I'm not just going to go out there and run uncertainly," as it is in the King James. "I'm not just going to be an also-ran. And as I fight," you know, boxers have a fight plan too. Boxers have a plan that they use. Some people, when they look at a boxing match, think, "Here are two people trying to beat each other to death," and especially women just can't see what men see in watching a prize fight. But really, in a prize fight, there's also a strategy. People have a fight plan. As I mentioned before, there are five questions that every executive is supposed to know the answer to immediately, like by knee-jerk reflex reaction. What are you trying to do? What are your objectives? What are your opportunities? What are your resources? And what is your plan or strategy for applying your resources to your opportunities to accomplish your objectives and accomplish what you're trying to do, fulfill your vision or your mission? When a fighter goes out to have a fight, he knows what he's trying to do. Perhaps he wants to be the world champion. And then in the light of that vision or mission, he knows what his objectives are. His objective perhaps is to win the fight that's before him. And then as he studies films of his opponent, and perhaps sees weaknesses in the opponent. He spots his opportunities there. And then he knows what his resources are. He knows what he can do as a fighter. And so his fight plan is, he has a strategy for applying his resources to his opportunities to accomplish his objectives and then fulfill his vision or his mission or what he's trying to do, become world champion. The same thing, as we pointed out, is true when a runner runs a race. You could say that the same thing's true when there's a football game. Well, this is the kind of language Paul is using, and he's applying it to the Christian life and to the ministry. And he's saying, Christ saved me on the road to Damascus, and he called me to a ministry. And in order that that ministry might be accomplished, in order that my mission, what I'm trying to do, might be fulfilled and accomplished, I've got a plan for the way I'm going to live my life. I know what the resources are. I know what the opportunities are. I know what the objectives are. And I can tell you, this is my plan for applying my resources to the opportunities that Christ will give me to accomplish my objectives, which is to reach people for Christ, so that my mission might be fulfilled. And to that end, he says, I have a plan. I have a strategy for running my race. I have a fight plan for fighting this fight. In order to accomplish these objectives and fulfill my mission, just as an athlete will subject his body to training and to a severe regimen of discipline, I do the same thing. I don't want to find at the end of the race, when I have enlisted others for the race, that I myself should find myself disqualified at the end of the race. Well, isn't this a marvelous philosophy of life and of ministry? I wish that the people in the pew, the people that I have pastored and the people that I pastor now, could have something of this philosophy of life and of ministry. To me, this is what a man many years ago called the normal Christian life. This should be the normal attitude that we have toward the life for which we've been saved and to which we've been called. Unfortunately, there aren't very many people in the ranks, especially in the church pews, who look at it this way. How God would be glorified, how Christ would be exalted, how the Great Commission would be implemented if more believers had the philosophy of ministry and of life that the Apostle Paul expresses here in these magnificent verses. Again, I would like to challenge you to read 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10 and see how this is the theme, this is the thread that runs through all three chapters. In chapter 8, he defines the problem. The meat offered to idols, is it right or wrong to eat it? Some in the Corinthian church said yes, some said no. It's in that chapter that he says, it's not what you know, it's how much you love. It isn't what's right or wrong, it's how much you love the person who thinks it's wrong, whether it's wrong or not. And of course, that focuses this issue. Well, why should what I do or do not do be controlled by somebody else's weakness? And then that introduces this great truth of love, of being Christ-centered and other-centered. In chapter 9, the first 18 verses, he illustrated how he himself applied that in Corinth by refusing to take support from the Corinthian church. And that leads to this magnificent passage beginning at verse 19 and going to the end of chapter 9. In chapter 10, he will go back to the Old Testament and bring out some illustrations, and then he'll return to this theme again about midway through chapter 10. Notice especially how chapter 10 concludes, and see if you cannot perhaps capture from the pages of this inspired letter the philosophy of life and the philosophy of ministry the Apostle Paul is trying to share with us, the Church of Jesus Christ.